Hello and a warm welcome to yet another episode on the Mission Chunya podcast. Wherever you are listening to this episode, hope you are safe and doing well. If you are a new listener, just a brief intro. Chunya means zero and Mission Chunya covers all stories around this global transition to a zero carbon economy. The podcast has over 50 episodes on a range of topics, so feel free to check the playlist from any platform that you're listening to this on. Subscribe to this if you would like to be notified when the next episode goes live in 2 weeks' time. This week, we are going to discuss an interesting topic around the theme of sustainability. If you are in the developed world, you wouldn't have noticed this, but in developing countries, this should definitely be given some serious thought. Our guest for this episode is Shalini Patwal. She is an infrastructure development consultant, passionate about climate change and sustainability, particularly in the context of water, which is the topic for this week. Over the past 16 years, she has been engaged in various assignments covering the entire project lifecycle of various sustainability projects with various government agencies, the donor agencies like ADB, FCO, etc. On this episode, she shares her views on urban farming from the perspective of water usage in developing countries like India, and how water usage creates divide in the community, the principles of equity, equality, and a lot more. So without further ado, here's the feature segment for this week. Hello, Shalini. Welcome to the Mission Chunya podcast.
Thank you, Girish. It's really nice to be here and let's have a great conversation.
Yes, the topic that we are going to discuss is, in fact, is a little unique. We haven't had this topic being discussed in the podcast, and I'm sure we will get a new perspective at the end of the conversation. So I'm really looking forward to this topic. So let's begin by looking at what is the topic that we are going to talk about. It's about urban farming. So why don't you start by giving us a brief perspective about urban farming in general?
Urban farming, or in other words, urban agriculture. Both the words are interchangeably used, and basically it means two different things in present day scenario, which is that if you grow food basically in your backyard for your consumption, it is called urban farming. But if you grow food to sell it to somebody else within an urban municipal urban space, then that is called urban agriculture. It's just a minor technical difference, but essentially it is about people growing food, their own food in cities and consuming it, right?
True.
But while it is an old concept, we have been doing it ever since the start of civilization. It was only in 1999 that urban farming as a system, as a concept, came into recognition, and FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, actually mandated that we have to look at agriculture production systems within the urban and peri-urban areas as an integral part of the food security, right?
Yes.
The idea where they started with was that it is a way of not only feeding the increasing, exploding population of cities, but also a way to create employment opportunities and generate income for the urban poor, look at other systems and means of ensuring social justice, food security, etc. So yeah, the concept, the terminology is relatively new, and the definitions and purpose of urban farming as such is still evolving, and as they start being applied to more modern, complex and diverse urban systems.
As you rightly said, it is an age-old practice, in fact, right around the birth of civilization probably. But in recent times, it started to pick up in a big way, and especially during the COVID lockdowns, the other big thing was people started buying saplings, started planting, and saw an increased uptake. So do you think it's really catching up now?
Yeah, and I'm kind of divided when it comes to whether it's a good practice or a bad practice, to be very honest, because people, even those who've been practicing, don't really look at it holistically.
We will get to that part of the conversation, but why do you think people pitch for it? What are the pros that people generally say when they pitch for urban farming?
Okay, so again, as I was saying, the context and diversity of the urban system is very important. FAO, when it started looking at urban farming, pitching for it as an essential component of our agricultural production systems, It was with the idea of helping the urban poor to meet their nutritional requirements, to generate employment, food security, etc., all that I was mentioning. In fact, governments in Africa and institutions like the African Development Bank make it a part of their essential strategy to meet these goals of poverty alleviation and food justice. However, and again, in the global north, we are talking about the developed economies, it has emerged as a very important way to reduce the environmental footprint of food that we consume. As you were mentioning, the pandemic and the resultant supply chain disruptions that has happened has made these countries look at urban farming as a means to ensure continuity of food supply, increase resilience, because traditionally developed economies rely on huge infrastructure and long associated transportation to look at their food security, right? The supply chains for the food they consume. So yes, they have been looking at it. However, I'm not sure if the same context can be applied to India, other developing economies, where typically land is a big constraint and our cities are very densely populated. So when we look at the economic and environmental returns of urban farming in these contexts, we might have to look at the social cost of access to land and water, as well as the environmental cost. So it is not a one case fits all scenario where you can say that it is positive to in every scenario or negative in a particular scenario.
That is fair. But like as you said, look at the other aspects to it. And people generally in recent times pitch the life cycle cost associated with farming, the food chain, and they pitch the ideas about my food has to travel miles together to reach me. So I am actually avoiding all the carbon emissions that is there in the transit. So I'm pitching for urban farming. Although that seems logical, you do have a different take to the energy, embedded energy in the value chain, if you can explain on that bit.
Yeah, see, first and foremost, urban farming does come with very clear benefits. As you were mentioning, it does have a huge impact in reducing the footprint of energy and water and carbon footprint, not water, energy and carbon footprint of the food that we consume, because you produce the place of production and the place of consumption is the same. So the entire associated emissions of transportation, storage, processing, everything is remote, right? So yes, it is a huge benefit in that way. And it also has other benefits like insight to environmental improvements. For example, if you, depending on the place you grow it, it can also work as a sink for the heat. It can work as sinks to absorb the excess heat generated by these cities and the concretized structures that is an essential nature of these cities, right?
Fair.
So depending on the way you grow them, it can either act as greenhouses that would harvest the excess building heat, or it can produce a cooling effect and reduce the energy requirements of mechanical cooling system. So it does have environmental benefits associated with it also. And thirdly, and the most important is urban farming does benefit in terms of enabling a very, very efficient way of upcycling the waste and energy streams. For example, if when we talk about upcycling, there is, as I was mentioning, excess heat that can be used for the greenhouse effect to grow plants. And at the same time, you have the waste, urban municipal waste that is generated, assimilated organic carbon and nutrients from urban waste, which can be absorbed by plants and it can, you know, be upcycled. So the waste becomes food. So that chain is established. So circular economy, waste upcycling, all of those benefits are there. But yes, it does have drawbacks that we are not quite looking at in a very comprehensive manner.
Yes, you are right. And you did mention about the global north and the developed world having different perspective to it. But we shouldn't actually be looking at only one set of the population, one set of the planet, and then look at the positives and neglect the side effects of it, particularly on the drawbacks. So give us a perspective on why you think urban farming isn't the same idea like throughout the world at this point. What are the drawbacks?
Okay, so to start with, there is no definitive research in saying that this is positive and this is negative when it comes to urban farming. In fact, the Technical University of Denmark and MIT reviewed existing scientific evidence, literature, and found that given the diversity of urban contexts and agriculture and techniques and the way it is practiced, we just don't have enough evidence to say one way or the other that it adds up to being a positive impact or it adds up to be a negative.
True.
So I just wanted to put it out there before we discuss pros and cons. So having discussed the pros, the drawbacks are quite a bit, in fact. So it starts with the energy aspects. Now, if you practice, in fact, they looked at some of the systems in New York and in other developed countries where they practice controlled environment farming, greenhouses, those kind of methods of farming. And they found that actually the energy footprint of the crops produced compared to the calorific nutrient values, it's just not worth it, right? So if you look at even other forms of urban farming, it has a very high energy footprint because of associated backward linkages. We are talking about using municipal drinking water. The very fact that you're using municipal drinking water for growing your crops is just absolute absurdity in a way, because one of the highest energy footprint of what you consume is the drinking water. Just imagine if we take the example of Bangalore. Bangalore doesn't have a river flowing through it.
Fair.
Water has to be transported hundreds of kilometers. That has huge energy costs associated with it. It has to be processed, it has to be treated, it has to be stored, and it has to be pumped continuously to the entire city. And then the waste has to be again pumped, it has to be treated in STP, and then it has to be disposed of. So when you look at the entire cycle of energy requirements for municipal drinking water systems, it is very high. So if you're looking at energy as such, it's just way too high. So that is one aspect. And then there are people who say that we use water from borewells.
True.
We are using groundwater. But then again, you're using precious, rapidly depleting groundwater resource for which is actually, if you think about it, is a community property, right? It's not
Correct.
An individual property. And more particularly, it is a property of the next generations. And you're using it for an individual benefit, and you're ensuring food security for yourself at the cost of water security of your own community, of the people living around you, as well as for future generations. And then again, if we talk about rainwater harvesting techniques, there the same logic can be used. Yes, a lot of people in Bangalore use rainwater. They harvest rainwater to grow vegetables, and I see a lot of YouTubes and articles, blogs coming up. It is their choice. But then again, if you think about it, the purpose of the rainwater is to recharge groundwater.
Exactly.
It's to recharge groundwater, which is again a community resource, which is supposed to be there for future generations. And if you're using that water and taking it and using it for your individual benefit, how much of equity is there? It's again a very big doubt there.
Yeah, exactly. This is definitely a question that has to be thought through in detail. But why do you think this sort of argument has never surfaced in this space so far? Because people who generally practice urban farming are generally people who are well aware of what is good, what is bad. But why do you think this idea has never percolated to them?
I'm not sure, Girish, whether it has percolated, it has not percolated. However, let me talk about something very simple. India mandates that we have to supply 135 LPCD, that means 135 liters per capita per day. And again, if we talk about Bangalore, BWSSP says that we supply more than 135 LPCD. However, that is where the challenge of averages come, you know?
True.
Because let's be very honest, some parts of city gets more than 135 and some parts don't get at all. So when you add it up and divide by the population, it looks like it is 135 LPCD. But that's not the case. So the idea of water supply as something that requires equity and equality principles is not really filtered through into our collective consciousness, because people who are in this field somehow don't talk, you know, we all talk about it. Rather, people who are in the water supply sector, it's one of our most principal priorities, while public don't really get to know about it. So let me explain a bit more about this, okay?
Yes, in particular, if you can give us outline about the need, the access to clean water? Why is it really important?
Yeah. Okay. So what is equality? Equality is everybody getting water. If in the context of drinking water, we are saying that equality is when everyone gets access to adequate water supply, then that is equality, right?
True.
Some might need more, some might need less, but as long as they all are getting adequate water supply, that is equality. Equity is slightly different. Equity is about what is the cost in which you are getting that water. So that is a different principle. Now, let me explain about equality and where urban farming might actually negatively impact the equality principle of water supply. Let's say somebody is using municipal water. And I know for a fact that a lot of people use municipal water. They don't think twice about using a bucket of drinking water to water their plants because they're getting enough and more water. And that's not an issue for them, right?
Yes.
But again, to go back to the principle of where India is, where Indian cities are, we are one of the most highly water-stressed areas, right? So we don't have enough water. So for a given quantum of water, what typically happens is that water is supplied to all the affluent communities in a city, affluent areas, domestic and commercial. And then the remaining water is supplied to the not so well off.
Exactly.
It is a fact of life. Irrespective of whether we say 135 is supplied or no, we know that even in cities where 135 LPCD is supplied, in the slums, people still queue up for a single bucket of water. It is not fully, freely, completely available to all of them. Adequacy of supply is still a challenge in India. Having said that, the equality principle is with a given source or given quantum of water available, if you drink more, then obviously somebody else is going to get less, right? And poor people, as it is, require lesser amount of water. And it is so less currently that they end up having to pay more for the same amount, for lesser water, for access to lesser water than what affluent communities actually utilize. Let's say, for example, a poor person utilizes significantly about 50% lesser than what a middle class or upper class family would require, a poor household. But what they end up paying in actual reality in, for example, Bangalore, is they pay double that.
Unfortunate, yeah.
That's where the equity principle comes in. Do you pay as much as a poor person pays for water? It might look like it is equality, but then what is the percentage of income that you pay for your water as opposed to them, right? That's where the equity principle comes in. Do you remember what was your water bill last time, the last that you paid?
I mean, actually, to be fair, since, as you said, since we live in a society, water connection and billing happens at one point. So I think it's about 200 to 300 rupees, which is about like $4 to $5 per month on an average.
Precisely. And
because we have, I think, both borewell and the corporation supply. So I think it boils down to that.
Yeah, but BWSSP in Bangalore charges for the borewell also. Groundwater is also charged.
Yes.
And the water supply during using the public utility is also charged. So typically, including sewerage and cess and everything else, you might be paying typically around 250, 350 rupees. But guess what? Poor people on an average in Bangalore, in the very same city, pay about 750 rupees.
Wow. That's scary.
They pay double to get half the quantity of water that you use. This is where equality and equity gets impacted. So for 750, they are getting as much water that they require. But the equity principle is impacted in the sense that because you know affluent people have used more water for cleaning their cars, cleaning their homes, for having plants and gardens, lawns, for urban farming, growing crops on their terraces. I'm not saying it's a bad principle, it's a bad idea, but I'm saying the usage is much, much higher. Washing machines and all the other non-potable purposes, non-essential utilization, poor people actually end up losing out on that water that they should be getting at the same price that you are paying, right?
True.
That's where the equity principle impacts. And somewhere down the line, one of the way in which it is impacting in the case of Bangalore, the Garden City, is when people grow plants thinking it is very good for the environment and for water.
That's a very good argument, a well-structured and well-thought-through argument. And as you rightly said, growing farms is just the last bit, because there are a lot of activities in a household that you just can't control. A tap that leaks, you even wouldn't notice, and you have to wash your car, you have to wash your utensils, and all this actually are also have a certain amount of wastage, let alone the other supply side of things where pipes and other things, all pipes also have wastage driven in them. So there is already a set inefficiency in the system, but this bit also adds to that. Whereas, as you rightly said, this can be avoided. I think that's where we will head to the conversation next. So in your opinion, like as you said, this is a big issue, especially in cities like Bangalore, which happens to be one of the most water-stressed cities in the world. I think it ranks in the top two or three, right after Cape Town or Joburg in South Africa. I think Bangalore ranks there. And it's a global phenomenon as well. So what else do you think people can do as an alternative to this idea that we have to eat good food, eat healthy food? What are the other alternatives that are really sensible for them to try?
Yeah, before I get to that, I would just want to expand on something that you just mentioned very interestingly about water stress. In fact, I'm not sure how many people are aware that India is ranked 13th when it comes to extremely water-stressed countries in the world. 17 countries are extremely water-stressed. India is ranking 13th in them. And the 12 countries are the MENA region, you know, Middle East and North Africa, the desert countries.
Which by default,
right after that is India.
That's very scary.
In fact, World Bank is informed that when it comes to water resource, we are living beyond our means, quote unquote. That's as bad as it can get. To make it worse, why India is ranked 13th? When it comes to people, 600 million Indians, okay, are dealing with high to extreme water stress in India at any given day. And about 200,000 people die every year due to inadequate access to safe water. That's numbers that is unthinkable. So when it comes to, water, we are in such a bad shape that we really need to know where the water is coming, how much water we are using, and where it is going. And water is not just about drinking water. Water is an essential economic resource. Without water, we just cannot grow as an economy. Every economic activity requires water. Production, manufacturing of every good literally requires water. Food requires water. So yeah, we are in a very bad shape. People don't even talk about water budgeting. We don't talk about so many ways in which we are not doing our bit for conserving this precious economic resource. So to get back to the question of what can we do? What can we do is to get good food. I would say it's a very simplistic solution, but it's actually comes with a particular background to it, is buy organic food.
Okay.
Why? Why? Instead of growing, why do I suggest you buy organic food? One of the very easiest, simplest ways is organic food typically consumes more effort, initiative, more land for lesser produce, right? Because we don't use any artificial fertilizers. Everything has to be natural. The soil has to be leached out. It requires a few cycles of growth and harvest for the soils to be leached of all the chemical impurities and contaminants and grow clean organic food, right?
Yes.
So when we buy organic food from a farmer, what we are actually encouraging is building the market. We are building the market for, we are developing a market which incentivizes the farmer to grow organic food, which incentivizes the farmer to improve soil fertility, to practice sustainable large-scale agricultural products. Now, one of the most important things that that happens when we grow plants in our backyard, so to speak, or our terraces, is we don't practice, we cannot practice economies of scale when it comes to water or other techniques, right? But a farmer can, because comparatively the land that is being owned is, comparatively, the land holdings are much higher than what you get in your terrace. So when you buy organic food, you're building the market, you are providing access, you're providing an opportunity to farmer to practice more sustainable agricultural practices. You are encouraging him to improve soil fertility. You're encouraging the larger consequent reduction in negative environmental impacts. And yes, it does contribute to long-term food security, because we can see that over a period of time, massive mismanagement of soil fertility results in lesser yield, which impacts food security. So while the overall quantum of food might comparatively in the initial terms come down because of the transition risk of shifting from traditional agricultural practices to organic practices, in the longer term, the risks associated with organic farming is much lesser. So yes, the very simple thing is it is more expensive, but go and buy organic food from a farmer. You're generating livelihood and you're doing your bit for the environment on a much larger scale than what you can do by growing crops in the backyard.
I just want just a small interruption, because this is definitely a good solution, a novel solution. I think the idea of organic food and organic farming has just got good attention in the recent past. But the other side, people, the naysayers, if I were to put it that way, they have this idea that how do I judge if the produce is really organic? That there will always be that doubt, right? Do you have any thoughts on that?
There are certifications that are there. There are very, in fact, the government also has some certifications going on. They have certified seed. The National Seed Development Corporation, NSDC, has certification programs. They sell certified organic seeds so that you can procure them and you can grow. And then the soil certification scheme is also there, so that if you want to be a certified organic farmer, you can go in for official certification. So there are food products, there are ways in which you can go about ensuring that you grow organic food if you are you are interested in farming. And there is also a way in which you can procure certified organic food. So that is another way of ensuring that you create a market for those certifications. The more you, a consumer, stresses the need for certified products, then obviously the certification improves, right?
Yes.
Like buying Hallmark Gold. People started believing in Hallmark as a standard and started insisting on Hallmark branded gold jewelry. So automatically the market for Hallmark certification improved. So this is another way in which consumers can drive the market, can their preferences can improve the certification process and the market size for organic food.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, a lot of points, especially ideas like soil certification is something that even I didn't know kind of existed, where you can actually validate the produce. That is really good to know. It's actually reassuring to know that, okay, you can actually verify and buy organic stuff if you're really interested, rather than trying to understand the science and learn the science and then cultivate organic farming. That is good. The other idea I think you would also vouch is buying local produce. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, so the other is not necessarily organic food is something that everybody might want to afford straight off the bat. As I was saying, the market is not enough for us to really benefit from the economies of scale if it is, you know, that is possible once organic farming takes off in a larger scale. So the next thing that we can do is look at buy local. I always say buy local, be local, because as I was mentioning earlier during our conversation, one of the largest footprints, environmental footprint of the food that we eat is because of the transportation involved, right? So the GHG emissions of the transportation from large distances for the food that we consume is really significant. So if we can look at generating networks, if we can look at some way in which we procure food from nearby localities, nearby places, that is a very excellent way in which we can do our bit to ensure that the environmental footprint of the food that we consume, our day-to-day footprint goes down significantly, right? I know in the case of Bangalore, Chennai, and Mysore, some interesting experiments, interesting ways of supply chains have developed where nearby areas, I believe in Jayanagar and in Baswankudi, they have started in Bangalore. There has been this concept where farmers, nearby farmers would come and there is a weekend market in somebody's terrace or the other where they sell all their produce and they go back.
Yes.
So that's an excellent way to ensure that the carbon footprint of the food that you eat is the minimal. And the second thing that might not be a very popular suggestion is avoid imported food products. We really don't need to eat food from a different country to ensure a nutritionally balanced diet. The reason I'm saying is, again, because of the carbon footprint involved in the levels of transportation and shipping costs, the air freight cost that is involved in importing foreign goods, right?
Yes.
I'm not about being against globalization, but yes, we need to be aware that more than globalization of economies and opening up, we also have to be aware of what we eat and the environmental and social cost of what you eat. If you buy from a farmer near our city that is generating livelihood nearby, instead of importing something from somewhere else, right? So we're talking about employment generation, we're talking about supporting local communities, we're talking about supporting the overall communal effort in communities' effort in reducing the environmental cost. So that is one thing. And the third, again, very unpopular suggestion is in terms of looking at what we actually eat. In fact, most of the top crops grown in India, rice, sugarcane, all of them are the top water guzzlers. Rice, just look at it. It takes one of the maximum water for growing. The paddy crops require one of the highest water footprint. And then we're talking about transportation. And then we're talking about the amount of water which is required to clean that rice, right?
Yes.
We use 3 to 4 times the mass of the rice to clean it. And then again, more water is required to cook it. So converting to, and sugarcane, we grow sugarcane in such levels and we export sugarcane as a nation, which is basically we are exporting our groundwater. Yeah, when you're exporting rice, when you're exporting sugarcane, you're not exporting sugar, you're exporting our precious groundwater to other countries.
That's another way to look at it.
Yeah, so look at least once a week, look at consuming millets, which have equal or more calorific content, but at a very low water footprint. So looking at our diet, looking at what we eat and how we eat and what goes into the production of these food crops itself is something that we can look at. I'm not saying we can do everything, but being aware of the choices that we are making and somewhere down the line, it will help.
Those are really valuable points. In fact, I think people should look outside their comfort zone and then look at the wider society as well. See how they can help people around in the neighborhood, people whose livelihood depend upon them buying products from them. So that's a nice thought to look at it. But at the same time, I believe you also say people can also do sustainable urban farming also. Your views on that. What can they do so that their effect is minimum? So I want to grow something, but how can I be more efficient in that? What's your take on that?
Absolutely. Again, to go back to the example of Bangalore or Chennai, both the cities have excess wastewater, treated wastewater that they don't know what to do with. Treated wastewater, right? And there is this mental block that everybody has that such water cannot be used for farming. In fact, there is a mental block to such an extent that it is dirty water that even industries don't use that water. In fact, Bangalore and Chennai are struggling to find takers for the industrial purposes, treated water. So the governments are trying to ensure that treated wastewater is used for construction, treated wastewater is used for industrial purposes, and still there is so much water left over. In fact, Bangalore has this program going on where they transport the water to treated wastewater is transported to Kolar district, and is used to recharge the groundwater there, the lakes and the groundwater levels, which is a very good thing. But then on a personal level, if we want to practice urban farming, there are very avid farmers, and urban farming, as I was mentioning, does have a positive environmental impact on cities. So a city without greens is a very poor environmental quality of life for its citizens, right?
True.
So when we talk about the most important things that we look at when it comes to sustainable urban farming systems, three things: location, crop selection, and techniques. So location is basically about how best can you locate. So if you have a terrace, if you have space on the topmost floor where the sun directly hits the building, growing crops there, having plantations there is the best, because that will, for a hot country like India, that will reduce the need for mechanical cooling systems. It will keep the building cool.
Correct.
It will generate passive cooling systems that we can look at by siting our plants in such a way that the building doesn't take the direct load of the solar heat, right?
Correct.
So that is one way in which we can reduce. The second is, and the most important, is crop selection. We need to know what crops to grow, how to grow, when to water it, how much water does it require. And ideally speaking, pick plants that require least amount of water. Plants are necessary for our local urban environment, quality of air, etc. But at the same time, pick plants that do not require as much water.
Fair.
That is the second. The last is in terms of techniques. In fact, it was interesting to know that there are networks available in other countries where they actively train, advise, and suggest techniques for urban farming for amateurs and interested people in urban areas in our cities, for the most water efficient way of growing different plants, different crops, right? And I'm not sure whether there are such networks available in India, but it is a good way to start off. So we need training in terms of how to use water resource efficiently, what are the best farming practices, how we can recycle water from our kitchens, bath water, how we can use simple techniques like simple hydroponics, drip irrigation, other practices, low-cost practices that can be done for small farming for a limited area like our terraces and our balconies that we can use. And these kind of techniques, dissemination of these kind of techniques, understanding, knowing these techniques is of importance, because this is where most of the water gets used up. In fact, some of the studies they have done in Europe and US, actually, they have been able to prove to a very limited extent again that people who practice, amateurs, as I was saying, we are not professional farmers. Urban farming, people who practice urban farming are not professional farmers, right?
Exactly.
So when they practice farming, they overuse water by more than 50%. So if a plant requires only certain liters of water, typically people who are not experts at it, people who are doing it as a hobby, tend to overwater the plants by 50%. So that's a huge savings right there. Once they know when and how much of water to be given to a particular plant, like wheat, rice, vegetables, every plant has a water cycle to it. They need more water during certain specific times and less water during the remaining time. So understanding that is a huge help when it comes to how they can save on water, how they can use kitchen water, not necessarily gray water, but water that is used for washing rice, for example. That is clean water comparatively, right?
Yes.
That water can be saved separately and used for plant for their gardens. So there are ways in which it can be done. It is about getting to know the techniques, being aware, forming networks with people who do this kind of thing very passionately. It has taken off in India also. But dissemination has not happened to such an extent. So having those networks work.
Those are really valuable points. As you rightly said, it takes some effort, it takes a mindset change, a different kind of an approach if people were to be more aware of what they are doing. And yes, it's still possible to be more efficient in the way you do things. So those are really valuable points. Shalini, on a final note, water as a subject, we spoke about what this current situation is in a country like India, and I'm sure it's the same around the world in water-stressed countries. What can actually governments do? Because water is such a central subject of the state. What can governments do to ensure that there is equity, equality, and everything that is being considered, and people, the general citizens, are more aware of it?
Start with what governments can do is they already know what they should be doing, which is adopt telescopic water tariffs. Okay, so they already know, but it is in a democratic country, they are so scared that they might lose votes and popularity that they don't even talk about it.
Fair.
In fact, one of the most interesting things to note is it is the poor who are against it. The representatives of the poor communities who are against it, they think that it means the poor will end up paying more. So let me explain a bit about telescopic tariffs in just a couple of layman version of it. Is basically that it's like the electricity slab, you know. Basic consumption is free of cost. And as it grows, as the consumption increases, you pay geometrically higher amounts. The slab itself becomes different. So for a normal family of four, a basic level of 135 LPCD or even 60 LPCD, let's say, for example, 40 LPCD is free. So Rajasthan government did that. It's an amazing thing, I think, what they did, even though a lot of economists might disagree with me. It is not much. We don't have to run our country on the money that we charge from the poor.
Exactly.
The basic consumption, the very basic to survive, what WHO mandates is about 35 to 40 LPCD.
Oh, okay.
35 to 40 LPCD is absolute minimum to sustain life, right? Give that free of cost for everybody. Above that, start charging so much that it starts pinching. So from 40 LPCD, say, to 135 LPCD, it should be nominal rates that we are paying. Continue keeping the nominal rates. But then when your consumption goes above that, there the billing has to be in such a way that it pinches. That is telescopic tariff. So a person who is using consuming water to a normal level, will not change anything, right?
Exactly.
It'll continue being the same way. And the poor will actually be benefited because they will get it free of cost. And let's not even get into the argument of whether they are ready to pay. Willingness to pay is a very, very common term for everybody to use. Are they willing to pay 100 rupees a month? Why should they pay 100 rupees a month? They are ultimately consuming very minimal water, 35 to 40 LPCD. We can give that free of cost. Let's charge instead, cross-subsidize it with higher tariffs to people who use drinking water to clean their cars and the road and pavement outside. Why not? Let's charge them instead of looking at whether the poor are ready to pay that much or not. And then we come to the second challenge of how do we know who is consuming how much water is by metering. And most of Indian public utilities are not metered, metered consumption.
Fair.
Municipal meter, municipal tariffs are still at flat rate. Everybody pays 600 rupees, 300 rupees, whatever.
Yes.
So ensuring 100% metered connections is something that we really have to look at. It should be a priority to ensure that the equity principles comes into play, that the poor are charged or not charged, depending on the amount of water they use, and the rich are, made to cross-subsidize the cost of it for over-consuming water resource, which is a community resource. And lastly, as governments and public together, what we can do is look more into how we use this economic resource. There is something called water budget. Nobody would have heard about water budget, right? There is a budget that is presented every year, that is prepared every year, talking about how much water should be used for agriculture, how much water should be used for urban drinking water, rural drinking water, economic activities, factories, etc., etc.
Yes.
So let's talk about where the water is coming from. How much water are we using? How much groundwater is there? How much are we consuming, over-consuming? How much of stress we have? And if we consume at this rate, what is going to happen to water tomorrow for our children? So I think water budget should have the primacy in our mental space as much as our finance minister's budgets do, you know, because we can earn money tomorrow, but we can't get water tomorrow if we drink it up today.
That's true.
Yes, water budgeting is very important. And I would want to close this by saying that every drop of water, drinking water that you use for anything other than drinking, just remember that we all should remember that this is water that we are taking from the mouth of a poor person who has to pay a lot of money for this very same water. In fact, I would want to go back to my experiences in Jaisalmer. I remember one of those trips where an elderly lady, she's a grandmother, and she was in tears because finally they have water supply in their town. And we were doing public consultations about the benefits of water supply, whether they're happy with it or no. And successive generations in her family, nobody has studied because the women spend 3 to 4 hours a day collecting water. So they don't have time to send their children to school. Successive generations have lost out on the economic opportunity to grow because of water. And finally, with this, her grandson is going to school. Her granddaughter is going to school. She was so proud. And she didn't even get water in her home, you know. That is going to come in a couple of years. As of now, she has water in her street. So as an intermediary measure, they had given water, drinking water access through a public tap in every street. And that has allowed her grandchildren to go to school finally, after generations of having a school nearby and still none of those children going to school because they all are busy collecting water. So when we drink water, we should remember this is water that is not available to a poor person.
That's wonderful. That's a nice little story towards the end, kind of to wrap up the entire conversation and around the theme of why is it essential to be more aware of the importance of water, the significance of water, not just to you, but to the entire society at large, because we just have to ensure that the planet is for everyone in the future as well. So that's a wonderful little thought to leave the listeners with. It's been an amazing conversation. It's been as I said earlier, I was sure that this discussion was going to throw off a different perspective for everyone who listened to this, because not many kind of will think from this point of view, because most of them probably who listen to this podcast would be having an access to water at will. So it's a luxury for them. So now with this conversation, I hope there is some thought in their minds and hopefully a small actions here and there will go a long way. Thanks very much for sharing your perspectives, coming on the podcast and taking time to do this, Shalini.
Thank you so much, Girish. I hope we can make one difference. One bucket of water saved is saved for our future. Thank you.
So yes, I hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it really insightful. Remember, urban farming can be done if the location, crop selection and technique is right. Being conscious of the right technique is essential for all level of urban farmers, whether you are an expert or just getting started. Water is a precious asset, and we have to give a second thought to people who have difficulty in accessing it. So let's do our bit to conserve and use water the right way. You can take this as an action item for this week's episode. Feel free to leave a comment, rating or review if you like the episode. A 5-star rating on Apple Podcast will go a long way in the show's global discovery. And of course, if you don't use the Apple platforms, don't worry, you can share the link to people in your network. Sharing it to 3 people will just take about 30 seconds and can have a similar impact. And thank you in advance for showing your support in spreading the message. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with yet another interesting conversation. Signing off, this is Girish Shivakumar, and as always, thank you for listening.